We're going to revisit today a subject that always has people's interest, and we're going to go back to the littorals and a discussion not just about the littoral combat ship either, but the challenge and the way we should be looking at planning and perhaps equipping and training our people best to operate and win in the littorals. Other nations have looked at that same requirement, and they've come up with different answers. And we want to look at, are we really defining our requirements properly in the face of the larger fleet needs that we have compared to other nations? What platforms and systems may best meet that challenge? And from our operational concept, well, we're really looking at the best way to meet that given what we are buying and what we are training and how we plan to employ them. And our guest to discuss this and more for the full hour will be Dr. Milan Vigo. He's a professor of joint military operations at the U.S. Naval War College. And it's kind of a stepping off point today for our conversation, and you can find a link to this at my home blog, but also over at the show page, is his recent article in the Armed Forces Journal titled "Go Smaller, Time for the Navy to Get Serious About the Littorals." Dr. Vigo, welcome to MidRats.
Okay, thank you very much for inviting me.
Yes, sir. It's a pleasure to have you this Sunday. Kind of wanted to start off in making sure that we define our terms properly. This has always kind of been a bugbear for me, in that we live in an age where we'll call it something, a destroyer that's the size of a World War II pocket battleship, and we have what is operationally looked at as a corvette, the littoral combat ship that's the size of a World War II destroyer. And in your article and other publications, you, I think, correctly, are really trying to define what is a small warship. How would you define what really is a small warship, and what nations are building platforms that really meet that requirement as you outline?
I would say that what I would consider a small warship, really the ship between 1,500 and 2,000 tons, I think, in terms of the surface combatant, you know, the probably submarine, I think, up to 1,500. But that's all really arbitrary. As you know, that we have problems in defining the small combatants and large combatants, and what used to be in the past, for example, the you know, size of the cruisers. Now we have destroyer size of the cruisers and so on. So there is a lot of turmoil, you know, in the post-war era in terms of defining properly what is a small combatant versus, you know, the large combatant.
Well, when we're talking about craft or littoral combat ships, what area of the sea space are we talking about these ships primarily operating in?
Well, that's a problem, I think, because I think it's a problem of definition. I think we use the term littoral, and littoral is explained differently, you know, by U.S. Navy, for example, and then also what is in geographic terms, what is in military terms. And I think what I think is a problem that the littoral really encompasses variety of the physical environments, and not all physical environments are equally challenging. You know, so I would say that certainly open waters or the U.S. West Coast, East Coast, South America, I mean, the waters of the continental shelf, we also consider these littorals. There's also one undefined area inland, which is littoral. And then we have what we call enclosed seas, with the seas with just one strait or choke point, or semi-enclosed strait, I mean, the seas which are with two or more exits. And we have also waters of the archipelagos, for example, Indonesian or Malaysian archipelagos or Solomon's archipelagos, which are surrounded by the open ocean and so on. So the variety, variety of the physical environments, and each of them, in my mind, you know, poses different challenges, you know. So I think the problem is really using this very broad, imprecise term, you know, littoral. I think that's one thing which needs to be, when we discuss these things, you know, we have to discuss also in which way, you know, each of these physical environments poses what kind of challenges, you know.
I think one of the really interesting things that you brought out, and I think it's a very good point in your article, is one of the big selling points people who are advocates of the littoral combat ship, they talk about how fast it can go. And you can, and we have dedicated whole shows to the history of a love of speed and the pluses and the minuses. But you bring up the fact, and you just touched on it on your previous answer, is conceptually there is a very big difference, and they've been conflated in the discussions of the operational use of littoral combat ships, and that is the difference between operating in the littorals and operating in narrow seas. And there are distinctly different challenges, especially when you have larger capital ships, carrier strike groups,
yeah,
expeditionary strike groups in narrow seas, and how you would utilize smaller warships or littoral combat ships versus operating in the littorals. Could you flesh out that challenge of the narrow seas that may not be
when
fully...
The term narrow seas is, I think, an old term. Some historians claim that started with the rise of the Elizabethan England, and its power, in the English Channel and North Sea. And then that term was revived in World War II, during the, the, especially pertaining to the contest of small ships, in English Channel between the German S-boats and the British motor gunboats and motor launches and so on. And then also in the Sicilian Narrows in 1940, 1943, and then later also in the Adriatic, So that term, narrow seas, really has geographic meaning, and they have also, it has also military meaning. So the geographic meaning really means the enclosed and semi-enclosed seas. In addition to that, also what we called choke points, that means straits, like Strait of Malacca, the Strait of Hormuz. So that's what we call, the narrow seas. In military terms, really, that concept is much more flexible because it depends on the range or the effective range of the weapons of which one side or the other side can control the certain area. So after the World War II, larger and larger part of the ocean actually became what we call narrow seas because it's under effective surveillance, or the land-based systems, so that's a military description. Now, there is also notion, that all narrow seas are shallow, but there are narrow seas which are deep, that means deeper than 200 fathoms, and also shallow waters, because these are, depths less than 200 fathoms. And so not narrow seas are necessarily deep. They might be also shallow. And so shallowness of water combined with a single or two exits and then proximity landmass, that's what makes actually much complex area to operate.
Well, Dr. Vega, let's talk a little bit about the threat posed in these littoral waters, and what would drive a need to have specialized craft and ships to operate in these areas.
Well, I think that first and foremost, in most of these areas, the countries, the navies, which are smaller, they are certainly much more used, and they also have a different fleet composition than we have, and they can pose, a serious threat to our ability to operate within the effective range of their land-based aircraft today, then also conventional submarines, the fast attack craft armed with missiles, the mini submarines, the mines, that's a major threat, the sophisticated mines, coastal missile gun batteries, and also in unmanned area vehicles, which can be also armed, and so on. So the complexity of these, I think they are diverse platforms which can pose great threat. Now, if the country like China, for example, has also sophisticated command and control system, then they can also use non-naval assets in addition to the naval assets to deny us, in case of war, the access, to large part of the, littoral area. I think the weaker side actually can integrate their defenses much better than the blue water navy, which is coming over the horizon. So, you know, they can integrate their land-based defenses, you know, the air defenses, the land-based air, and the naval defenses, you know, with sophisticated command and control systems, you know, and to pose a significant challenge to our ability to project power in that area.
At the end of the opening paragraph of the article, you make a pretty interesting point, especially in an era post-Goldwater Nichols where everybody emphasizes you know, joint professional military education, joint this, joint that, etc. And you state, brief quote here, naval doctrine to date does not emphasize the truly joint combined arms operations necessary to modern war in the littorals. There's a, unquote. And there's also discussion later about the need to have fully developed operational concepts. What is missing in the CONOPS that we're using to think about fighting and winning in the littorals? And where are the gaps that you see in that joint combined arms operational approach to looking at requirements and whether we're really building and training and equipping the right force to be able to succeed there?
I think there are two aspects here. One is purely naval, that I think is, if one agrees that littorals pose a very different challenge for operations of Blue Water Navy, that also leads to the conclusion, okay, that we need to think, you know, which platforms are most, the best, the most suitable for the, you know, operations in littorals. My personal view is that you need combined arms approach. Similar to what we have, you know, surface forces, submarine, I mean, subsurface forces, and naval air for blue water operations. Similar concepts should be also applied, but with different platforms in littorals. And in my judgment, littoral combat ship, no matter how good, even that is without any controversy, is not sufficient to ensure the control of the littoral areas. And we can integrate. I know that we plan to network, you know, the LCS with other platforms, but it's still just one type of platform. And that one type of platform is not sufficient to effectively operate in the littorals. Doesn't resolve our problems in littoral warfare. Another aspect, I think, is the joint. The littoral warfare is inherently joint. That means the Navy must find a way to, any Navy, you know, to integrate land-based air and also, in some cases, also Army to operate together with the naval combat arms. So that's what I call combined arms approach.
As we apparently are looking forward to building 55 or so LCSs and we continue to build the Burke class DDGs, are we approaching this wrong? Should we have fewer LCSs and build another class of smaller combatants or a series of different classes of smaller combatants?
Well, you know, my personal view that LCS is not suitable for you know, for littoral warfare. I mean, for littoral operations, you know, it's too large. I don't think that even modular approach, the way we approach, is proper. I think it would have been probably better to take approach the Danish Stamflex 300, has, where you have certain elements, you know, which are unique, you know, and then you can, modules are then built for certain missions, you know, and so on, and the ship stays with that mission. I think it's too optimistic and too ambitious, you know, to have a single platform to, you know, exchange these modules. You know, we now know that will take much longer time than was originally thought and be effective. I think it's too large. It's also the speed. We can discuss about speed. My personal view, the speed, high speed for LCS is not necessary. So I think we need to think how I see it. You know, we need to have a family of the corvettes. And there are a lot of very good, very well-designed ships, you know, overseas by our friends in Germany, also Israel, for example, Saab 5 corvettes, or French were built, you know, they built for the export Sigma-class corvettes. I think we need SSKs, the conventionally powered submarines, And I would also argue that we should not abandon legacy, what they call legacy MCM, dedicated surface MCM forces, you know. And plus the naval air, you know, the helicopters, you know, UAVs and things like that. I mean, this is what I would consider that would be probably necessary to have what I call arbitrarily littoral combat groups, you know. Now, these littoral combat groups cannot operate alone. They will not survive that environment. So they need to be protected by larger and more capable force, but they should be operating in a certain, you know, certain missions which are, you know, they are capable to do in littorals. And I will argue we should not use large surface combatants, you know, including LCS, in this kind of very challenging environment.
The one thing that always concerned me about a lot of the discussion for the littoral combat ship has been naval warfare in general, and especially in the littoral. Many times when combat finds you, it is a war, you come as you are. And the whole mission module concept, it assumes you know ahead of time what your threat is going to be, i.e., you show up in a body of water ready to do surface warfare, and next thing you know, you have a periscope come up. You can't call a training timeout, go back, put on your ASW gear, and then show up to play. And the question I have, the smaller you get, you run into square footage and displacement issues. So there reaches a point where a multi-mission platform really cannot get any smaller and really be effective. Are there some nations out there who have developed some smaller warships that truly are multi-mission, ready to effectively meet either a surface threat or a submarine threat that will come at you in minutes by, you know, the two-week delay to go change your mission modules? Are there some out there that you find have really done a good job of meeting that small multi-mission combatant requirement?
Well, I would say that there are several candidates, you know, I mean, in my mind, you know, which might be much more useful for us, our purposes, you know, than LCS. One is certainly Swedish Visby-class corvette, which I think is a great platform and well-designed, and I think has really enormous potential. Another one is a Braunschweig-class corvette, K-130, the Germans. They had some troubles in terms of the, you know, initial design and so on, but I think it's a good design. SAR 5 class, which was designed by the Israelis, but was built, you know, by Litton Ingalls Shipbuilding Corporation, Pascagoula. So it was built by us and has a very balanced, I think, surface and anti-surface capabilities and anti-air, and also ASW capabilities. So another one is a Sigma class corvettes, which is built by the Sheldon Naval Shipbuilding for Indonesian Navy and Royal Moroccan Navy. So these are, in my mind, three or four. And they also have modular design. Sigma class has a modular design, too. In my mind, modular design, how I see it, you know, that should be a uniform hull, you know, and propulsion and number of sensors and so on. And then based on the, you know, weapon systems, so on, you can build the ship which is primarily anti-surface or ASW or anti-air, and having that function, and then use them in as a part of the littoral combat groups, you know, and so on, and not exchanging the modules, you know, based on the submission requirements, you know, which are unforeseen.
So, as I understand what you're saying about these littoral combat groups, is they would consist of several ships, many of which have differing capabilities. So you'd have a few ASW ships, a few anti-surface warfare ships, a few mine ships, countermine ships in that operation. Is that where you're going with that?
Yeah. I think that should be. I don't think that's my. I would like to say that, you know, your listeners should not think that I'm not against the modular design. I think modular design is an excellent way to go, you know. But what I think that the single platform should not be designed that can alternately, carry out several of these missions, you know, and adding or constantly some other missions, you know. I think should be either primarily ASW or anti-surface or anti-air or as a command ship or logistic ship and so on. You can build a number of these platforms around the same core capabilities, you know. And I think this speed, in my judgment, in littoral waters, especially in shallow waters, is really not much use. You know, I remember my days when I was a torpedo boat commander and so on, and we had a 45 to 47 knots platform. There was Soviet-built section class and so on. And the most of the missions we planned was really from ambushes. And we were hoping if we can, you know, deliver the torpedoes from those days from 3 miles range, you know, which I was not sure we would even survive, then high speed would be used to essentially escape. But the high speed was not really that important for us. And so I was always buffered, you know, with this idea that a 3,000-ton ship, you know, needs to have a high speed, and then between 30-40% of the whole cost and so on is really due to the high speed.
In the last decade, when the build-up to supporting and pushing forward the whole LCS concept, one of the things that was thrown on the altar to make LCS happen was a complete abandonment of the multi-purpose frigate. You know, the OHP was our version of that, of course. And Undersecretary Work has been very famous while he was in the job, Undersecretary, of announcing, you know, quote, you know, we don't need frigates, very emphatic about that. And part of that was his insistence that, well, if you really need the capabilities of a frigate, then we can just have our allies do it. And I think when you look at the separate ROE and the various caveats that other nations bring to any type of combined operation, we saw that in Afghanistan. We saw that anti-piracy off of the Horn of Africa, where you know CTF-151 had 23 ships, of which 5 he could actually do something with because of ROE and national caveats. Is what do you think, besides sacrificing one thing in order to be able to fund another, is there a good point to be made that we don't meet or we don't need frigates, or is there a blind spot in a mistake that we made in looking at our larger, you know, fleet composition planning in the last decade?
Well, I think it is really, from my perspective again, you know, and I'm not privy to many of these discussions, and I'm, you know, not trying to you know, say, okay, my views are the only correct views. That's far from that. You know, in my personal view, that we have put too much emphasis on efficiency versus effectiveness. And I think that's also led us, you know, I think, to add more and more missions to single platform. Now, if you have more and more missions, none of these missions can be performed properly, really, in just in basis of training or personnel. Another thing is also, I think, historically, and I think I hope Professor Van Hughes have the similar view. The smaller, the fewer missions you have, is better, actually, historically. You should not have more than 2, maybe 3 missions. You should not have multiple missions on one platform. I think what I would argue, that should be a mix of the platforms with different capabilities, and they organize them properly. In terms of surface, I would say probably when I was talking earlier, I'm also in favor of what they call light frigates. There's light frigates, corvettes. I'm not sure that we should go, you know, to fast attack craft, you know, and things like that. I mean, but certainly the Visby class, which is about 600-650 tons, is a very good platform, I think, you know. Now, as you know, there are drawbacks to these platforms. They have to be forwardly based. There is a lot of problems with the logistical support and so on, but I think they're excellent for what they can do.
Well, that does raise a question I have about when we sail our blue water fleet across the ocean to go to war. You know, we can do that, but if we've got a bunch of these smaller 600 and below ton ships and craft, Is there a logistics problem, a transport problem? How do we get them out there?
I think that's a logistical problem, and I'm not trying to, you know, say that this is. I think that all certainly can be resolved. And I would say this: you know, not all littoral areas require forces. What I was suggesting, there are only a few areas. It said clearly, Persian Gulf is one. You know, I would say also the areas, you know, in the South China Sea, East China Sea. So there are only a few areas where you really need these kind of capabilities, you know. If you're operating over the open waters, you know, the Africa and so on, you I would not argue that you need, you know, this kind of platforms. But I still need, in my judgment, we still need SSKs. Not only that, just to increase the number of the submarine force, you know, in terms of numbers, but also I think in terms of capabilities. And I think that one of the greatest, how I see it, you know, very often when you suggest these kind of things, then they will say, well, you know, you are against SSNs. Well, you are not against SSNs. The SSKs are not substitute for SSNs. They complement their capabilities in certain areas. That's all what people like me, you know, argue.
Obviously, when you dig too deep into it, everybody starts wanting to go behind the cipher door. But over the last few years, we've had our friends in Sweden and I believe Peru and Colombia and maybe another couple of nations have sent their SSKs to us, West Coast and East Coast, to be integrated into exercises. And I remember back in the day going against the holes in the water, I mean the Dutch. The Dutch small submarines and the German small submarines and the Norwegians, just incredibly challenging tactical platforms to try to go play around with. They've reminded us a lot and have maintained some continuity of the challenges that come into the littoral environment when you're trying to go after submarines from a training point of view. And one thing that's always been a concern, and there is, to totally get away from U.S. National, there's plenty of open source stuff about the challenge that the British had in the Falklands when it came to false contacts and expenditure of ASW weapons on those small contacts. And when you look at what we talk about being able to actually, if you find it and you need to get rid of it, how you kill a submarine, you know, the Mark 46, the Mark 50, the Mark 54 lightweight torpedoes, is that really our only and best answer? And do we need to look at other possible capabilities that other nations have that gives you a little more of a diverse weaponeering toolbox to use against these small submarines in shallow water that goes beyond taking a Virginia-class SSN inside of the 20-fathom curve to chase down a 1,500-ton SSK?
Yeah. Well, I personally think that we need to go. I mean, there are a number of the we talked earlier about the surface combatants, but I think in terms of the SSKs, you know, certainly we have experience with Gotland. We certainly have experience in exercise with Type 212, and then there is an export version of Type 214, which is a German AIP submarine. The Scorpène class, you know, the French, I think French also developed the Andrasta class for littoral warfare, which is much smaller, like think about 850 tons and so on. So there are a number of these smaller platforms which are cheaper and also highly capable. And I think there should be a mix, you know, of the SSNs, you know, and the SSKs. Though, you know, going back to your, you know, statement, you know, not your statement, but Mr. Bork, I agree. I mean, I have high respect, you know, for Robert Bork. I don't know him personally, but I think, you know, we really cannot rely on allies, others, you know, to provide these capabilities. We just cannot. Another thing is also when you don't have these platforms in your own force structure, I think you really don't know, you know, their capabilities. Now you can train with them, you can, you know, with these kind of platforms from a different navies, but it's not the same as you have in your own navy, I think. And the same pertains to the corvettes, you know, and the light frigates and so on.
Well, you've raised a really interesting question of training, I think, and you know, our sailors now are blue water carrier group, and with the exception of probably the amphibs, don't worry much about the inshore environment. But how long would it take us to train up, you think, a group of people who are experienced with this type of platform to be able to operate in these littorals with a littoral combat group and all the necessary components?
Well, I really don't know in terms of, you know, and I hesitate to say so many years and so on, but I think it takes a long time. I think we can actually, how I see it, we can actually send certainly some of our officers, and I know we have sporadically sent to some of the other navies, but to some of these platforms which we might, you know, eventually decide or whatever to have it, to be, you know, on board these platforms, you know, and to learn about, you know, before we actually acquire them. And what I'm suggesting is not something which can be done overnight. I mean, it takes some time, you know, before. But I think one thing which is most crucial is really to change our views, you know, on the littoral warfare, and to embrace this littoral warfare, not just as a rhetoric, you know, but really that littoral warfare is different than the, you know, warfare in deep water, and require the deep study of the operating areas, understanding of the character of warfare, which is different than on open ocean, and then require different forces. And then, you know, you need then to develop theory, and you have also to, based on theory, you have to develop the sound doctrine. So there are a lot of things which have to be done, you know, but I think if you are delaying these things, you know, and not doing certain, then the timeline will be much, much longer.
Yeah, nothing in this line of work gets better by being ignored. And when you look at recent experience in, you know, littoral combat, and a lot of your assumptions get thrown away the minute triggers start getting pulled, two things that come to mind. I'm just would like to bring up one nation's experience recently, and that's Israel, who's had a lot of long dwell missions off of the Lebanese coast and off of Gaza. And two things that come to mind. One was one of my critiques of a lot of the CONOPs and the vignettes done for LCS, and for that matter, Zumwalt class, is they have them going off these non-existent shores that are totally vacant of human beings. There's no cities, there's no piers, there's no high-rise buildings, but the reality is, off of Lebanon, of course, the Israeli corvette got a little lucky when it got hit by the anti-ship cruise missile launched by Hezbollah right off the coast. And when you look at that part of Lebanon, you know, you can hide those things in somebody's garage and backyard or in a parking garage. And also in their operations off of Gaza, they use precision fires from their gunboats using, and it's the name of their system is slipping my mind all of a sudden, but it's a combined missile and gun system, very exact, literally flying through the windows, that gave what we really need in the era where you're trying to avoid collateral damage, that very, very accurate, detailed fire, very specific, very discriminating. So are there other things from Israel's experience with small combatants in littoral, both that sudden strike like we saw in Gaza, but also the long dwell littoral campaigns where they were off monitoring the forces off of Lebanon, that we really should try to absorb as we look at how we would operationally use the LCS as they come into the fleet, because it is all we have at this point more and more?
Yeah, I agree with that, but I think I will go also historically. I think that's one problem with us. I think there are a lot of things which we can learn from recent and more distant history. In terms of Israel, I think there are quite effective employment of their missile boats, you know, in Yom Kippur War or Ramadan War in 1973, or the Mieta Baltim, you know, and the Latakia is quite instructional, I think, for us. I think that's one example where the Israelis they overmatched, you know, the Soviet-built boats, you know, on the part of the Syrian Navy and the Egyptian Navy. So this is one experience. I think we have certain experience in Vietnam, you know, of the coast, you know. And another thing is also, I think, we need study of the areas, you know, where the littoral warfare area was very intense, you know, during the World War II in the English Channel, North Sea, we say the Central Mediterranean, the Adriatic, 1944, 1945, and the Solomons, you know, in our own experience, you know, in the Solomons. And I would say even Solomons, we have enormous, you know, historical knowledge is lacking, actually, understanding. I'm not saying nobody has written anything, but I think in terms of littoral warfare, we have not studied, you know, and we have a very rich and very, very positive experience, you know, in 1942, 1944, in the Solomons.
Well, You were a Yugoslav Navy PT boat commander. U.S. have pretty much abandoned its PT boats after World War II, and every time it gets raised, the people who raise that get slapped down. I mean, we don't have the experience, the useful experience with small boat operations. And that's very true.
We have PT boats experience in Solomons, but when I'm referring to Solomons, it's not just PT boats, but destroyers, you know, and amphibious ships, and we have a lot of experience in, and these are really classically total warfare, actually, you know, in the Solomons. The struggle for Guadalcanal and New Georgia, Bougainville, and so on. And I would say over the 2 years, you know. And I think it's not just a PT boat, but talking about PT boats, you know, as you know, their capabilities are now much, much, much greater. And I think that all views about PT boats, I don't think they're valid today. We cannot prove something which is not done, you know, but I think they will have much better, much higher effectiveness today than there was in 1941, 1945.
So well, you make a good
very,
point.
Very different.
The destroyers in World War II and during the Solomon operations were about the size of the current littoral combat ship. So the point is well made. I'm really concerned about getting from that experience, which was 70 years ago, to a modern fleet. And I see difficulties in training people up, especially since the higher levels don't often look with great favor on something that's outside of the norm.
Yeah, well, I would say that if we had a modest force of the platforms, surface and subsurface, fully capable operational littorals, we will also improve greatly training of our junior officers, before they reach the point where they take over commands of destroyers and cruisers, because they will have experience in running, commanding much smaller platforms, I think that will be also one additional benefit. I'm not saying that because of that we should have a littoral combat force, but I think that will be one benefit of that. And plus, it will also increase the number of numerical strength of U.S. Navy.
We could almost spend the whole show on that. I agree with you. That's always one. And again, it shouldn't be the primary driver, but you look at positive secondary benefits of having a more balanced fleet. Is I don't think you can have enough opportunities for lieutenants and lieutenant commanders to have command, because then when they get in charge of these multi-billion-dollar destroyers and cruisers and amphibs, they've perhaps learned a couple of hard lessons that didn't make the front page of Navy Times, so they don't do it in a major combatant. I wanted to back up a bit. You've raised it a couple of times, and I think though it seems ancient history, it's not. And for this reason, you were discussing the experience in the Solomon Islands off Guadalcanal, the multiple battles of Savo Island, and also something back to where you were spent your time as a young man, the experience of the Austro-Hungarian Navy in World War I versus the Italians in the Adriatic, and also the battles off of Savo Island. Those were narrow seas in the littoral, but you had major combatant ships, not unlike what we do in the Persian Gulf, Arabian Sea, up in the Western Pacific. Up close, near shore, you had both of those experiences. These warships, whose weapon systems were designed to be long range, were firing at zero elevation, or in a couple occasions of the Solomons, you had small boats going towards the major combatant ships to the point that their major weapons could not be elevated low enough to actually hit them. In the modern context of that, you have aircraft carriers and you have anti-ship cruise missiles. Ships designed to fight at maximum range, however, are operating in areas where they are very close to having a very short notice engagement. Is that part of your concern, that we haven't studied our own history enough and that we're not inculcating those very real lessons that sometimes it's not the long range that's going to get you, it's when you get close to the threat that's going to present the challenge to you?
Well, I agree with that. I mean, you know, the historical lessons are, there are many valuable lessons regardless when the, you know, actual combat took place, you know, and I, in the, you know, in the conversation, we, I didn't add, you know, that littoral warfare was also conducted, as you know, in World War One, World War Two, in the Black, in the Baltic, and also in the World War Two and World War One in the Black Sea. So you have many areas, you know, and I think regardless of the side which fought, you know, whether Germans or Soviets or Russians or anywhere else, we can derive a lot of lessons, in my judgment, which can be applicable, fully applicable today. That's history is one part, I think, but it's also, you know, it's based really all on geography, you know, and the warfare in the littoral is very different. As you know, you have, first and foremost, you have a much, especially in close, semi-closed seas, you have a much smaller maneuvering space. Then if you add minefields, you know, then minefields also add to the problem, because that maneuvering space, which is already small, is much, much smaller. You have a you know, ever-present danger from the attack from the air. And that means without stronger air, you cannot simply operate in the littorals. So that's my point, you know, when I wrote about littoral combat groups, you know, you cannot operate these groups, you know, regardless of their capabilities alone. They had to be protected by much stronger force from beyond the horizon. Otherwise, they cannot survive. And then, you know, encounters are brief. They're mostly night, you know, bad weather. Density of contacts is much higher, and you have a presence of enemy ships and neutrals and so on. So many of these areas, you know, which we discussed in various aspects of warfare, are very different and very much more complex, you know. And I think, I'm not sure, I cannot say that, you know, it would be exaggeration to say nobody is, you know, nobody knows that, you know, this is all known, you know, but I think, I'm not sure that we really paid adequate attention to the character of warfare in littorals versus the warfare in deep water.
Well, I was listening to you, I was thinking that one of the campaigns you didn't discuss in World War II, but I think also fits into your mold, is the Okinawa campaign,
yeah,
with the fleet under attack from land-based aircraft and stuff. Is,
yeah,
that is that something else you have in mind?
Yeah, yeah, I agree. Yeah.
One thing we discussed earlier, I want to kind of pull the thread on it, is the when you look at nations, we discussed Israel. You can also look at Sweden and Finland, how they have addressed the littoral challenge. One thing about the U.S., though, our blessing of being surrounded by two huge oceans and friendly neighbors, it's the distance required to be able to do operations globally. And when you have the smaller ships in the littoral, obviously you have less ability to maintain your ships. They need resupply on a regular basis, whether you want them to or not. And we used to have a fairly robust systems of destroyer tenders, especially during the Second World War and even up through the Cold War. You could pull up to a tender and they could do about anything that you would want. And it would seem that it would be logical, if we're going to have 52 or maybe less littoral combat ships that would need to be forward deployed, we may not have access to a shore facility close enough to where they're going to be needed to be able to sustain them in an effective manner. Is there a reason to look again from a logistics and a maintenance standpoint? And what to smaller combatants do tenders bring to it? And even in a modern concept, is that something that we should look at, perhaps helping us utilize these ships that we're bringing into the fleet?
Well, I agree that we need, you know, to think about logistical, forward logistical base, you know, for them. You know, they clearly cannot operate, you know, on their own, you know, for a very long time without maintenance, you know, repairs and refueling and things like that. But hopefully, you know, if we operate in certain areas, we should have some allies and coalition partners which actually can, and I would say that's probably one of the major things I would say that we might, you know, be capable of obtaining from our allies and logistical support, I think. We have to think about what we can do, but also we can probably rely much more on this kind than just on their capabilities, I think. But absolutely, I agree with you that we need to revisit this problem, you know, and then certainly the recommended or suggested littoral combat force, you know, needs also have problems, you know. It's not that just everything is good, you know, everything is you know, favorable. But I think these problems can be resolved. Everything can be resolved, I think. And we are not talking about very large force, I think. But I think, you know, I would probably, among all these platforms we suggest, we discuss, I would say that probably the most urgent, in my judgment, is really SSKs, I think, that we should supplement our, you know, very capable SSM force, you know, with some modest number of the SSKs, I think.
You go on?
When we start talking about the LCS, I think occasionally some of us have described it as similar to the camel, which is a horse designed by a committee. How did we get the design that we ended up with, or the designs we've ended up with in this thing? Is this a committee that ran amok, or is this one guy who took something and kept throwing things into the mix, or why do we have this thing instead of something?
That's a really difficult issue for me to really properly answer. You know, I would say just in generic terms, you know, the Navy has to get into business or designing requirements, you know, and so on, and essentially dominating the whole process, you know, and not letting contractors and others sometimes, you know, to run the show. You know, I think we have to go what we used to do very well, you know, in up to 1970s, I think. And the Navy can do it. I mean, one of the greatest strength was always designing and acquisitions, you know.
Yeah, we are better than what some of our recent performance is, and that's just, of course, my opinion. Other people will have different ones. I wanted to bring us up to something that the last month was in the newspapers a lot, and I think a few people roll their eyes at it, but performance speaks for themselves. Korea, North Korea specifically, was in the news a lot recently, and most of it was focused on missiles and nuclear weapons and stuff. And when you talk about their conventional forces, a lot of people roll their eyes and say, yes, it's a bunch of old technology, but they have a lot of it, no big threat. But the North Korean Navy actually has done some operationally impressive things. Their midget submarines have a regular habit of inserting forces, operating close. I don't know which of their submarines did it, but one of them torpedoed a South Korean corvette within the last, I think it was a year and a half ago. And the North Korean coastline, if something did come up, that is very, very littoral, and there is a threat, however archaic it is, operational, working. We've talked about mines this afternoon. The North Koreans definitely have a tremendous mine capability. When you look at the various options that could happen in North Korea, whether we wanted to or not, are there a couple of gaps that we need to be very conscious of in that littoral, in that confined space against midget submarines, smaller conventional submarines, and mines that we really need to make sure that we have in mind if we move close to shore with North Korea?
Well, I agree with you, you know, and it bothers me also, you know, various statements. We make this kind of statement not only in regard to North Korea, but sometimes in regard to Iran and some other countries. I think it's very dangerous, in my judgment, that no potential opponent should be ever underestimated, you know, and this kind of statements, I think they're not helpful, in my judgment, you know, that you have to take all these potential, you know, opponents seriously, you know, and prepare for that, you know. In regard to North Korea, I would say, yes, ASW in shallow water and MCM. I think these are two major issues, I think, which we had to resolve somehow, I think. And again, I think the force of that's not really our problem, it's mostly problem of South Korea. I think the best response to small combatants, you know, like a fast attack craft, is really a force of your own fast attack craft, you know. So this kind of capabilities has to be built up, you know, I think.
To what extent, when we talk about having more SSKs for the U.S. Yeah. fleet, but to what extent can we rely on our allies, Japan and Singapore and some of the other countries that have been investing in such submarine capability? Is that something we will allow us to just maintain our SSNs?
Well, I think we can rely to some extent for some of the missions, but I think how I see it, you know, SSKs and corvettes and light frigates and land-based and shipborne helicopters, you know, and MCM, they should form what I arbitrarily call littoral combat ship. That means they have to be integrated part of that force and properly equipped and properly trained and indoctrined and things like that. So you really cannot rely, you cannot do this with the foreign navies, I think. But I'm not saying that we should exclusively rely on some modest capability on our side. We should certainly rely on for certain things if we are involved together, you know, that they can do certainly you know, much good, you know, and that should not be neglected, you know. But the reason is that you cannot integrate Japanese, let's say, SSKs or Australian and so on into your littoral combat groups very easily, I think. Now, if you don't go that way, you're not going to build any force, you know, specifically organized and trained for littoral warfare, then the only option is to, you know, having the other navy's capabilities, you know, somehow integrated with your own blue water force, you know. But I will opt actually rather that we have a combined arms approach, you know, in dealing with the littorals, you know. And, you know, the blue water segment, area strike groups, you know, expedition strike groups and so on, SSGs and so on, they should provide that over horizon, you know, support, distant cover and support, you know. That means suppressing the enemy air defenses, land-based air, destroying enemy fleet at their bases and so on. But the other missions, you know, which are much more, you know, specifically for littorals should be really the task of what I call littoral combat groups, you know.
When you go to the other side of the Pacific Promise, you run into a nation that is pretty easy to look at what their requirements are for, you know, littoral, narrow seas, near shore. And that, of course, is China. They can look at the South China Sea, Taiwan scenarios, operations inside the first island chain that rolls in a lot of what you've talked about, where in those waters they have ready access to land-based air, that combined arms ability, and the ability to operate their smaller ships under an umbrella of some very interesting shore-based area denial weapons for other forces, whoever they may be, who are coming from the east, who wants to get in close to shore. Looking from here, how do you look at what China has done in the last couple of decades to build their forces? And there are some things you think that they are doing well intellectually, translating an intellect into production, and are there some areas you think they might be a little bit off-center from what they should be focused on?
Again, I'm not, you know, I don't consider myself a, you know, Chinese expert, but I know certain things about their doctrine and certainly operational art and their force structure. As in case of North Korea or Iran, you know, they're striving, you know, to learn from us, you know, and to build a credible force for what I call anti-access area denial should not be underestimated, you know. But now they have certain, you know, in terms of the force buildup, I think they have doing some good things. I think they have a lot of, you know, SSKs now. You know, last 15 years, you know, I think 50 or something were built, and then the frigates, you know, and the missile destroyers, and strengthening also the amphibious capability and our carriers and so on. And then also they have littoral force, you know, the missile craft, the new highly capable missile craft and so on. I think what their strength is really that they can integrate all these capabilities, both naval and non-naval, you know, and what we call network, you know, and be much more capable to deny that area if China, what you called, what you mentioned earlier, the, within the first island chain. Well, I think their problems are, I think the doctrine is overly dominated by the army, and I think it's pretty rigid doctrine. It reminds me, a lot of their doctrine reminds me of the Imperial Japanese Navy, or, you know, during the World War II. And it's really overly focused on geography, and I don't think it's very flexible. And I'm not sure, you know, to what extent their training is, realistic. I know that they're making a lot of efforts, you know, to have a joint training. I know they're also very high on the integrating information warfare capabilities, what they call, into every, you know, aspects of the warfare. And I think this is one of the areas where we should really pay great deal of attention, and we should not look somehow, you know, thinking they might not be able to do it. You know, I know there was some statement by one high-level official saying, well, the Chinese Navy that, you know, doesn't have a combat experience. Well, that's very true, but I don't think it's relevant. You know, I mean, you can go historically and look, you know, the German Navy prior to 1914 didn't have any combat experience, you know, but they performed pretty well. And I, you know, so this is not a very good yardstick, you know, to anticipate what actually might happen in case of some conflict, you know. So they have some strength and some weaknesses, you know, but I think I will take them very, very seriously, you know.
One of the strengths of the U.S. Navy appears to be headed toward using more unmanned vehicles, both subsea, surface, and in the air. Does this allow us to skip a generation of small surface combatants if we use those, or are they just another adjunct to a littoral combat group?
I don't know. I will use. I agree with you. I mean, there are a lot of benefits, a lot of advantages using unmanned vehicles. But I think the problem is, how I see it, this kind of systems, as much as they are capable, should not be somehow looked like a substitute for the manned systems. And there are certain, you know, things which unmanned system, no matter how good, they cannot do it. And so while we have to use them, we should also be very realistic, you know, and not thinking that this is a panacea for all our problems, you know, in the littoral warfare. And most of these systems are not really combat tested. That's another problem, too, you know.
As we're getting near the top of the hour, I wanted to indulge my a selfish question on my part. I wanted to go back. I always like to give guests an opportunity sometimes to feed the brain of some of our listeners. And I greatly enjoyed your article from Joint Forces Quarterly back in 2010, Military History and the Study of Operational Art. And I've always believed that, in general, naval officers don't read enough history and don't really look in depth of a lot of the work that's done on the operational art. And everybody knows traditional people, you know, read Sun Tzu, read Clausewitz, et cetera. But one of the classic thinkers of the operational art, if you could, you know, give a passing advice to a junior officer coming through and he said, you know, who should I read right now to help flesh out my intellectual development? Who would you say they should grab and read more of if they haven't already?
Well, I would say that the junior officers and any officer, you know, should read all the classics. There are things, any classic, regardless whether we agree or disagree with their ideas or whether these ideas are, you know, today maybe out of date and so on. We need to read and to understand, you know, because they also had major impact, you know, on various militaries, on the training, you know, and the doctrine. I would say certainly read Alfred Mahan, read Julian Corbett, which is probably more relevant to today, in my judgment, in his you know, ideas about degrees of sea control. I think read also one of our great strategists, Bernard Brodie, who was civilian. Read Raoul Castex, the French vice admiral, who wrote a five-volume book on the strategic theories, and the theories of the French Young School, you know, in late 1880s and so on. So these are, from naval aspects, you know, these are kinds of things I think the officers should actually read. I think, if I may say, you know, from my perspective as a teacher, the problem I find in in terms of the Navy is really the need to go and to somehow debate these naval theoretical issues. You need a commonly accepted body of knowledge or naval theory, and without naval theory, you cannot possibly develop sound doctrine. And without sound doctrine, you cannot properly train the force. I think that's what is major problem, I think. And I think one reason why the naval officers and others, not only in U.S. Navy, but in many others, they have basic misconception of how the doctrine, how the naval theory developed. Naval theory is developed based on practice. Practice always dominates doctrine. So based on our experiences in the past wars and, we derive certain aspects which are, common, and that's what comprises, body or naval theory. So naval theory is really key, and then based on naval theory, again, to have a sound doctrine. And history. History is one of the things, which naval officers should all read,
Absolutely. Well, Dr. Vega, we've had a very fast little over an hour now.
Yes.
Before I let you go, what can we be looking forward to from you in the near future, and when can we get you back on our show again?
I don't know. When you ask me, I will be glad to be on your show. The one thing I'm actually trying to do is larger major study on littoral warfare, actually, And one aspect of that is also writing the history, actually, of the war in the Solomons, I think, which is a great case study for littoral warfare.
I look forward to seeing that. Well, thank you very much, sir, for taking the time to be on with us this afternoon.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate having me on the show. Yeah, appreciate it. Thanks.
Look forward to talking to you again.
Yeah. Okay. Bye-bye. Thank you. Yeah.
Yes, sir, thank you very much, and I wish everybody a great Navy day, and we'll catch you next week for another edition of Midrats. Cheers.
Groceries is about to get even easier because a brand new Walmart Neighborhood Market is opening soon near you. Enjoy low prices you can trust every day on your grocery favorites like fresh produce, quality meats, and more. Plus, Walmart's friendly pharmacists can take care of all your prescription needs. At Walmart Neighborhood Market, shopping and saving are simple and convenient.
Your new Walmart Neighborhood Market opens October 28th at the corner of McQuaig Street and Highway 84 in Waycross.
Save money, live better, Walmart.